On Friday, October 18th, the Norris Group proudly presents its 6th annual award-winning black tie event, I Survived Real Estate. An incredible lineup of industry experts joins Bruce Norris to discuss perplexing industry trends, head-scratching legislation, and opportunities emerging for real estate professionals. Proceeds for the event benefit Make-A-Wish and St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital. This event would not be possible without the generous help of the following platinum partners: Property Radar and Sean O'Toole, Housing Wire, the Apartment Owners Association, the San Diego Creative Real Estate Investors Association, and President Bill Tan. Investors Workshops and Sean Watkins, Angel Bronzegeest, and Sarah Benora. Invest Club for Women and Iris Veneration and Bobby Alexander. San Jose Real Estate Investors Association and Geraldine Barry. MVT Productions. Wilson Investment Properties. Rhoda Construction. And White House Catering. For event information and tickets, visit isurvivedrealestate.com.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today our special guest is Doug Duncan. Doug is Fannie Mae's Vice President and Chief Economist. He is responsible for managing Fannie Mae's Strategy Division and Economics and Mortgage Market Analysis Groups. In this leadership role, Duncan provides all economic housing and mortgage market forecasts and analysis, and serves as company's thought leader and is a spokesman on economic and mortgage market issues. Doug, welcome back to our show. Really appreciate you being here.
Thanks. Glad to rejoin you.
A year ago, how would you describe the housing market a year ago, and now how would it be different today?
Well, a year ago, we were saying there are signs that we're making the turn, but there's still some uncertainty about it. Today, we would say housing is definitely on a different path, and that path is a path toward recovery, but we're not at recovery. Directionally, we're going correctly, but it's not yet robust. And a couple of the things I would say is that the recent discussion about house price increases, from our perspective, are all being driven by supply factors, and there's yet to be solid evidence of growth of organic demand, and that in particular represents a risk to robust growth if we, in fact, see the change in interest rate profile to be one where rates are going to be rising. So heading in the right direction, but not robust.
Okay. Now, what would be your definition of robust? Apparently, it's not just price increases, because we've had those.
That's correct. The first thing that we commented on in this regard was what do we believe the longer-term level of construction should be in the business, because that's the primary contribution to GDP growth from housing. That should be at something north of 1.7 million units annually when you combine multifamily, single-family, and manufactured housing.
Okay.
And our forecast for this year is about 950,000. So that's a long ways from being back to normal levels.
Now, a builder would love to build 1.7 million. Why are they not? Because they must think it's not profitable to do that yet.
Well, I think it's more logistical. If you think about the depths of the crisis, when we got down to building around 600,000 units at the bottom, mm-hmm. That was a period when a lot of builders were struggling to stay in business. They were releasing land options or selling land outright to generate cash to stay in business. A lot of them have to go back and reacquire land. After they reacquire the land, then they have to permit that land. Then they have to find labor to build on that land and materials for that labor to work with. The unemployed workers, of which construction workers were the largest decline in employment of any employment group in the economy. Those folks haven't been sitting around for 4 years, presumably hoping that construction would start again, but probably moved off to different jobs. So the builder community has to rebuild the labor supply either by changing wage rates to encourage some of those people to come back to construction or by training new people in the trades.
Okay.
All of that takes time. It's not as though there's not an economic interest given what we've seen with price increases, but it just takes time to accomplish some of those logistical challenges.
Well, to your point, in California, you know, I look at a subdivision creation as the barometer for a builder's, let's say, confidence in the future. And right now in Riverside County, where I happen to live, and it really has a kind of an economic base that Riverside does very well when construction's going on, we're still down 95% in lot creation. Even though we've had a 30% price increase, it doesn't seem like the builders are willing to create new subdivisions. They're willing to build on existing ones.
Right. Yeah, I think that's building on the existing ones gets them past some of those early hurdles where they probably have permitting in place so that they can act faster on that to take advantage of the opportunity, and presumably they're trying to build out on the backside for the parts of the process that take longer. I grew up on a dairy farm, and someone would ask my father something about if such and such a change takes place, will that make everything better? And his response to that was, the first thing that has to happen if you're going to get a harvest of corn in the fall is that the tractor has to start in the spring. And to some degree, that's what's going on here.
Okay. Now, you're very right on the supply side. You know, in California, over 2 years, we've gone from around 6.5 months supply. Some places are under 2 months supply. The question is, where would the inventory come from to glut the market, let's say? You know, 6.5 months supply down to 2 months took us on a journey of one pretty healthy price increase.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I look at 2 months supply and I say, okay, well, where are all the houses going to show up from now?
Right. I think there's at least two or three things. One is we've talked about construction, which is going to be slow. The second one is there are probably households who believe they owe more on their house than it's worth, and they may or may not have taken into account the price increases to determine whether or not they could actually offer their property because of price appreciation has brought them out from underwater. There's also a significant number of loans still in serious delinquency, and the longer it takes to work those through, either through a short sale or through a foreclosure, for those properties to be freed up on the supply side, the more of a constraint that is as well. So I think you have at least those hurdles in addition to the construction piece. And then we have been surveying consumers now for the better part of over 3 years. And one of the questions that we ask is it a good time to sell a house? Initially, for the first 2 years of the survey, that stayed flat at 10%. The reason we asked the question is 5 out of 8 people who are going to buy a house have to sell one first.
Okay.
So then we saw, starting in 2012, it started ticking up. In November of 2012, it was up to 20%. And so at that point, we, in our press release, said, well, we think housing's on a firm footing. The trend line is right and will be sustained, but that doesn't mean it's robust. That figure is now up. It's the last couple of months, it's been bouncing back and forth between about 35% and 40% of people thinking it's a good time to sell a house. So we've made substantive progress, but that means still less than 50% of people in the market think it's a good time to sell a house. So that may or may not be keeping them from offering their properties as well, even if they're not underwater, for example.
Have you done any research on, let's say, the person that does, stays current for 5 years of being underwater, and then they finally get some equity? It, to me, they would seem to be the least likely to want to go from ownership to renter. But I wondered if you've asked any of those people, is that group just can't wait to get rid of that house and just go pay rent somewhere? Or have they really proven, you know what, we want to own through thick and thin and we're going to stay an owner? I'm just really curious about that group.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if we've asked it. We haven't asked the question that way specifically, but I would infer from the combination of responses related to that they are likely to want to remain an owner, but they may want to move to a different property to own.
Right.
That is, that they may have been a constrained move-up buyer, for example. So they would actually reappear simultaneously on both the supply and demand sides in the market if they were now out from underwater and ready to transact, less likely to move toward rental.
Well, we've got this 2 months supply, and again, some of the areas you just covered, where's all the inventory going to come from? We're sort of hamstrung by builders not doing as much as they normally do. We've got still people that are underwater or barely just above water who probably yet won't sell. And,
right.
And so you look at to the demand side, describe what you mean by organic growth.
I mean, people who have gotten jobs or gotten better jobs are in a position to want to become homeowners or to become move-up buyers, but most importantly, first-time owners. And there, what we've seen is the worst growth, in fact, no growth in real incomes subsequent to the recession.
Right.
In other words, we have seen no real income growth at the household level since the end of the recession. So, and job growth has been weak. With the reason the unemployment rate coming down is because people have been leaving the labor force. All those are factors that come out of the demand side of the equation. And until we see a ramp up in employment, and here there's a little nuance that I think we don't understand yet, but are questioning whether the job growth that we have seen is disproportionately greater share of part-time jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And those don't have the financial strength that full-time jobs would have as a lever toward becoming a first-time home buyer. So population and demographics is really in the long run what drives housing, and we still see household formation at well below levels that it should be at given where we are in demographics. I think we're still well short of the 1.2 to 1.3 million households that should be forming under normal circumstances.
At some point, and that's because of economic reasons, maybe the habits of the echo boomer generation is they wait longer to form, permanent marriage type unions, that type of thing. I guess mm-hmm. The question is, are we about ready to play catch up?
Well, people, that's the hope. Because we do have the highest share of 16 to 34-year-olds living at home with their parents that we've ever had.
Right.
All of that should be a part of the unfolding of the demand curve. But until we see significant job and income growth, it's hard to figure out how that will happen.
You have to have the capability growth at the same time.
That's exactly right. Yep. And
yeah.
if we were to see strong job growth and rises in real income growth, then I think that number would unfold fairly rapidly, but this has just not been that kind of an expansion.
Do you really need, and this is just a really honest question, do you really need the wage growth because you had such a real cost of housing go down due to the interest rates, the all-time interest rates being low? So is that sort of trump the need for a raise?
No question that affordability has improved, partly by policy, that is the intentional driving of interest rates down through monetary policy, and you also saw house prices fall substantially. So households recognize, and we do survey for this, young households do recognize that this is a good time to buy a house. That number has been very strong, and it's not that they're not interested. They actually see this as housing. That's the group that sees housing as an investment the most positively. But they're also saying, but we want to be sure that we have our finances in shape to buy the house, and we also want to make sure that we have our finances in shape to maintain the house once we buy it. So they're exercising what I would say is prudent caution about getting their financial household in shape prior to making that commitment, because they've seen the cost of not doing that.
So would you say the reason for buying, if I asked that question to a 2004 or 5 participant, the answer would be very different from the 2013 buyer?
It would. The 2004 or 5 household would have focused on things like tax advantages, capital gains treatment, appreciation, worry about being able to get in because of the pace of sales. So you'd have gotten a lot of financial answers, whereas today you get a lot of qualitative answers.
Is it human nature that will shift once again once homes go up?
It certainly can. There's no denying that that is a possibility. Hopefully memories will be a little bit longer than that.
Oh, I doubt it.
Probably not.
That's the way people are.
If you live in California, one of the interesting things that we've been talking to folks about, I was out in California a couple of weeks ago, is that the last time that there was a significant rate spike in a short time period, one of the responses that occurred in the housing sector was a spike in adjustable rate mortgage usage. And California has year over year been the highest market share of adjustable rate mortgages. But the rules have changed now so that underwriting an adjustable rate mortgage requires that it be underwritten at the maximum rate that it can reset to in the first 5 years of its life, which is essentially what fixed rates are at today. And as a result, we've not seen the spike in adjustables that we saw in the 1999-2000 and the 1994-95 experiences. And so we're wondering how that will ultimately impact markets that typically are heavily armed markets, like California.
As prices go up, what we had just kind of reflected on was that the mentality of the buyer changes. They go from being this conservative, I just want to make sure I can make my payment, to could we own two or three and look how much we made on the last one. Do lenders drink the same Kool-Aid, and do you see that progressing at some point where lenders start creating programs that are more aggressive in the private, if they're privately funding them, not necessarily connected to Fannie, Freddie, and FHA?
Right. If they are a regulated depository institution, I would doubt that you will see that response, because regulators are going to be on that risk-taking. In fact, it's part of the reason, in my view, that we haven't seen more expansion of credit or credit has remained tight. If you look at the overlays that lenders are putting out there today, I view them as being as much a response to regulatory risk as they are to credit qualification kinds of issues. So I think we won't know for a while how well, because for one thing, not all the rules have been written, we won't know how well the changes in regulatory structure will constrain the ability of those institutions to take on more risk. Certainly will be, it's always an urge, because you don't make money if you're not doing business, right? So.
Well, I was also thinking that a lot of their business came from refis over the last 5 years, and in the next 5 years that might decline. It already has declined. I was just talking to Deborah Still.
Absolutely.
By, 70%.
And this is, the thing that's different about this downturn is that it is the after effect of a specific policy set that was intended to, by design, to lower the average rate in the outstanding mortgage portfolio. When that policy impetus is removed, then there's got to be some sort of an adjustment period to get back to what would have been the level of market-based activity, and that will take some time.
Mm-hmm.
So it may also drive some consolidation among lenders, especially since there are a significant portion of lenders who are heavily populated in the refinance space, and if they didn't look forward on how they were going to adjust their cost structure in a purchase market, they may well leave the business.
What percentage of the market does Fannie and Freddie combined now have? Would you say?
No, we don't know for sure exactly how many dollars banks are putting in their own portfolio that we don't see. But it's if you throw FHA in there, it's certainly the three of us, FHA, Freddie, Fannie, are in the 90% range.
And right now it seems like everybody's doing very well as far as the recent crop of loans go back 2 or maybe even 3 years. Wouldn't that be one very profitable group of loans that were created?
Oh, absolutely. The early payment defaults on those loans are very low. It's a very clean book of business. The underwriting substantially stronger than in the bubble period, no question.
Is the emphasis still on downsizing to ultimately make a big change away from that type of financing?
Well, obviously, part of the policy environment was for the regulator to work through the GSEs to increase guaranteed fees and underwriting criteria to find the point at which private capital would find it profitable to supplant the business that the GSEs are doing. That's a reasonable thing to think about. Certainly that is a contributor to why the performance of these books is so good, but yet we haven't seen much involvement of the private capital, depending on how you define that, but if you define it to say these are lenders that would come in and make loans or issue securities not involved with the GSEs. I have to believe a part of that is simply because they haven't reformed us. That is, let's suppose that you issue a private label security that is somewhere near the fringes of the business that either of the GSEs does, and then the reform of the secondary market is such that it actually turns that security into a story bond.
Mm-hmm.
Those story bonds have adverse pricing relative to the broader, more liquid markets, and so there's likely to be the case that some institutions are sitting on the sideline waiting to find out what the final rules are before they put their capital at risk. So I do believe a part of it is the need to move on reform of the GSEs.
Okay. FHA just announced a change in policy as far as 1 year after a bankruptcy or a foreclosure or short sale that they'll make that person a loan. So that would seem to be a positive thing for demand, and at the same time we're talking about maybe reducing loan limits. We only have another minute to go, but any of those things important to the markets doing well?
Well, certainly you're right. It would have an impact on the number of people that might qualify for credit going forward. If they were to also lower the loan limits, that would also raise the question of whether private capital would step in and at what price it would step in the area where there previously FHA probably was dominant. So that's another area where we may see some advancement.
We have 45 seconds left. There's still a lot of people waiting for that shadow inventory to show up. Are we waiting in vain?
I saw some data this morning that said the time to take a loan in Florida all the way from initiation of foreclosure through the completion of a foreclosure sale was about 900 days,
yeah.
That's 3 years.
Yeah.
Unless they're going to go out and hire a whole bunch of judges specifically focused on that, I'm not sure how you accelerate that. Our view when we look at the supply side of the market is that aspect of the market will just gradually trickle in, and the market pretty well understands that now, so that when they're thinking about the construction of the full supply curve, that's counted as a factor. So unless something substantive comes along in the administrative or legal process that accelerates that, we just view that as a gradual contributor on the supply side, but no big rush to the market, which would unsettle prices significantly.
All right, Doug, thank you so much for joining us. Doug, Chief Economist at Fannie Mae. It's been a pleasure as always.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
The Norris Group would like to thank its gold sponsors for supporting I Survived Real Estate, Adrenaline Athletics, California Property Solvers, Coldwell Banker Town & Country, Claudia Buys Houses, Elite Auctions, Phoebe, For Investors by Investors, In a Day Development, Inland Empire Investors Forum, Inland Valley Association of Realtors, Investor Experts Inc., Keystone CPA, Las Brisas Escrow, Lavis Associates, Mike Cantu, Northern California Real Estate Investors Association, Northern San Diego Real Estate Investors Association, Orange County Real Estate Investors Association, Orange County Investment Club Phoebe, Personal Real Estate Magazine, Pilot Limo, Primary Residential Mortgage, Realty 411 Magazine, Rick and Leanne Rossiter, Southwest Riverside County Association of Realtors, Sonoka Corporation, Spinnaker Loans, UDirect IRA, Tony Alvarez, Westin South Coast Plaza. See isurvivedrealestate.com for more on the event and all of our sponsors.